Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. These days, if we want to find out if a movie is worth seeing, we have a multiplex of choices to search on the internet. There's Rotten Tomatoes, IMDb, and my personal favorite, Metacritic. But back in the 70s, it wasn't so easy. You basically had to rely on the opinion of your local newspaper's movie critic. Until two rival Chicago critics, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, teamed up to create a groundbreaking syndicated TV show that would change how we discovered movies. If you could stay up late enough, you would stumble across Siskel and Ebert and hear them weigh the ins and outs of all the new releases. Their signature thumbs up or down rating system influenced millions of moviegoers and more than a few filmmakers. Award-winning editor and film critic Matt Singer has set out to capture the lasting legacy of both men and their show. He is the author of Opposable Thumbs: How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Singer shares the incredible story of how these two tastemakers became pop culture and critical icons themselves, and why it all sprung from their incredibly fierce crosstown rivalry.
They started reviewing movies for their respective newspapers in the late 1960s. I believe Ebert was 67 and Siskel was 69. So between 69 and 75, when the first shows started airing, that's like 6 years-ish. And they had, an epic rivalry through that time, I would say. All sort of, maybe not long distance, but sort of like when you see someone you don't like across the room at a dinner party and you just glare at them, that sort of energy. Roger would talk about how, you know, they would be attending all the same press screenings in Chicago and they would see each other at functions, events, and they would look at each other and they would not talk to each other. If they were waiting for an elevator together, they would stand awkwardly in silence because they both knew and felt, at least, that their jobs were to beat the other guy in print, write the best reviews and get the best access and interviews with stars and directors and all of that. When the opportunity to do the very first show arose in 1975 at the PBS station in Chicago, it really comes down to the fact that the show was not their idea. They were sort of brought in to host it and kind of paired together. And so, you know, it was really just kind of the smart sense of the people doing that we wound up with the great team that became known as Siskel and Ebert.
How did the pilot for their show go?
Badly. It went very badly in almost every way. If you are a fan of the show like I am and grew up watching it sort of in the early 90s through the end of the series, you might be astonished by how badly it went, given how good they became as this wonderful, charismatic, funny, insightful on-screen duo.
We're really rough on the films that we like, and the films that we don't really expect anything from, we're a little bit easy on.
We shouldn't allow it to be lost in our discussion that we do think it's a good film, basically.
Yeah, and one worth seeing. It's playing right now, I guess, at the Esquire Theater, and it's going to be there for a long time. It's going to be a very popular film.
They're not very good. They don't have any chemistry on camera. Apparently off camera, the combustible energy was always there, but bringing that on camera was the thing they struggled with initially. You know, they're sort of sitting in a balcony, but it doesn't, you know, it just doesn't have the same juice. It is kind of a fascinating document, but it is not a success.
Thea Flum played a valuable behind-the-scenes role in getting Siskel and Ebert ready for their close-ups. What did she do to make Gene and Roger ready for primetime?
Well, they always credited her as sort of, you know, she was not the creator of the show in the, you know, traditional TV sense. She did not work on that pilot. She was brought in after the pilot when they decided to make more episodes, but they understandably wanted to kind of spruce things up a bit and try to get Siskel and Ebert working a little better on camera. And they always credited her as being the one who figured out, again, how to take this off-camera, whatever you want to call it, competition, rivalry, animosity, and figure out a way to turn that into something that worked on camera. And, you know, she really worked with them. I mean, they would go to her house on weekends and work on their scripts because they were both very good writers, but they were writing for print and writing for newspapers. And it is very different writing a print review versus writing a TV film review.
In the early 80s, Sneak Previews was a big success. It was airing on hundreds of PBS stations across America. And Siskel and Ebert even started making rounds on the talk show circuit, including a memorable appearance on an episode of Late Show with David Letterman. What happened?
So what happened was, the show began to do pretty well on PBS. And that was when they started becoming really full-blown TV stars. They were, you know, in their heyday, they were as famous as a lot of the people in the movies they were reviewing, for sure. They were essentially kind of set up by producers who were people who were doing the pre-interviews, getting them ready for this appearance. And they were both told to tell this very be prepared to tell this specific story, a funny anecdote about them jointly interviewing Jack Lemmon. And when Letterman kind of prompts it, because they both want to tell the story, neither will let the other tell it. And it becomes this huge, genuine shouting match. They are really angry and annoyed and frustrated.
I'm the butt of this story, and yes. It's always funnier if the guy tells the story that is the butt of it rather than the other guy telling it on the first guy. And besides, you can't tell good jokes.
I can tell it real quick.
Slap him, Roger.
Let the audience decide.
Okay. And I'll ask the audience which joke was funnier, the box of chocolates jokes or the hanging up and down by the ankle?
I'd like to make my statement now. Okay.
Girls, please, settle down.
Anybody else on the planet would have eventually said, look, you tell the story. Okay, you tell it. And maybe would have tried to chime in somewhere. But because of who they were and this hyper-competitive relationship they always had, no matter how they felt about each other, and they did start to like and even love each other through the years, they always were competitive. You know, and afterwards, they were a little embarrassed about it, supposedly, as Roger later told the story in an article he wrote. Especially, you know, they felt bad because they had, you know, gone off on each other on TV. And as they were leaving the Ed Sullivan Theater, a producer on the show said to them, that was a great segment. That was great TV. And that kind of summed it up. It's like, yes, they would yell at each other and scream, but it was great television. Because, especially on a talk show where everyone's nice, everyone's happy, everyone's new movie is the best movie they've ever made. Let's go to the clip. Thanks for being here. It's so great. They brought legitimate honesty, authenticity, and this air of drama that you didn't know what they were going to say, and maybe they would get into a huge shouting match, which, I mean, the talk shows, when someone else is on, they can be fun and pleasant and amusing and charming and enjoyable, but they don't always have, like, drama that they very consistently brought to those kind of shows because they always did them together, and there's lots of examples of them fighting like that. So I'm a huge fan of Siskel and Ebert in the show, but I mean, some of those clips from Late Night are some of my favorite things that they did together.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. It was always entertaining when Gene and Roger had very different opinions about a film that they were reviewing. Is there one film fight that stands out most to you?
You know, I like, there's sort of different kinds of fights. You know, it's like you watch, as I did for the book, you watch hundreds of episodes, you start to see that they had different sorts of fights about different sorts of things. And amusingly, they could fight about a movie they theoretically agreed about. They could give a movie two thumbs up and spend the entire review fighting about why it was good, why they liked it. They would see totally different things in the film, which was another, I think, huge factor in their success, is that you really were getting two different points of view from two guys who had very different ways of looking at and thinking about movies. If they agreed about everything and they saw every movie the exact same way, it would have been a pretty boring show because every movie would have been, yeah, this is good. I agree. Okay, next movie. The magic of the show was that they often did not. And even when they agreed on a kind of final judgment level, they often disagreed about why. And there's one example of a movie they both gave thumbs down to that I find very amusing.
I also thought this movie was over about 10 minutes before it finally ended. I can't recommend it, but I probably ought to say that younger children might find it entertaining.
Dim-witted younger children.
Oh,
younger
no, don't children. Say that,
yes,
Jim.
I want to be the
at
cruel
a certain
one.
Age, at a certain age, younger children are just younger children.
No, at a,
you don't have to insult their intelligence.
No, at a younger age, certain kids will sit there if their parents take them to a brainless piece of entertainment. This is not quality, and I don't want you suggesting that people might like it. I think that they, you know, I
that was not uncommon, that Gene would be like, a good movie is a good movie is a good movie, and this kid's movie is not a good movie, thumbs down. And Roger might look at it and say, well, these things are relative, and relative to the standards of children's entertainment, thumbs up. Or perhaps I'll give it a thumbs down, but I will tell you that I do think that it works on the level that a kid might enjoy it. And they would, and then they would fight about that, where they're not even really arguing about the specific movie. They've used this movie as a jumping off point to a kind of a higher level discussion of what makes a movie good? What makes a movie bad? How do we determine that? Is it good if it's if it appeals to every audience, or is it good if it appeals to its target audience?
You've said that you admire the work of both Siskel and Ebert. Whose work do you admire more?
Okay, that's not fair. That
what do you mean now, it isn't fair?
Well, because, like, you know, you can't... I mean, I will say that, you know, that because Gene passed away in 1999, you know, and so young, that from that period until, you know, the end of Ebert's life, I really became like a really hardcore Roger Ebert fan. And that was the period where I really discovered, you know, not just the TV side of things, but his writing. But I will say that going back and watching the show, it really made me appreciate how good both Gene and Roger were. And I really, you know, like some people ask me like, well, who was your favorite when you were watching the show as a kid? Did you, were you a Roger guy and or a Gene guy? And I never really had a favorite. And I think to me, that's part of the magic trick of the show is that to me, they always felt evenly matched. And I sometimes agreed with one and sometimes agreed with the other, but that I loved seeing them talk, listening to them. I will say about Gene, the thing that I really genuinely admire about him, especially as a film critic and speaking from experiences, like the degree to which he prided himself and really was honest about his opinions, you know, no matter what, is, I think, a very valuable trait in a critic, you know, that if it didn't matter if every other critic on the planet was saying Apocalypse Now was a masterpiece. If he didn't think it was, and he didn't, he was going to say so.
But the big payoff, and this is the ending is unfortunately there. There is a journey up the river, and we get there. Brando has nothing.
The ending didn't work for you. It worked more for me. I think that essentially the two of us are representing the two basic attitudes toward this film. Some people think the ending doesn't work, and it's just another war movie. Other people think that it transcends other war movies. It's a little better, a little more brilliant, a little more important. I'm in that camp.
Okay, and I guess I'm saying to people, if they go and they wonder what the heck is the ending about, I'm with them. I wondered too.
Gene would often give negative reviews to directors he would say he loved or actors that he loved. He had no problem saying, that one didn't work. This was a miss. This, you know, you'll get them next time, essentially. That sometimes is hard for some critics to do. And Roger would sometimes say maybe he was honest to a fault. I don't know that it was always a good thing that he was so honest, but I think in the realm of criticism, I do think it was very much an asset, and it's one of the things I loved. Again, going back and revisiting his reviews is that authenticity and that honesty was always there.
What did Roger feel Siskel and Ebert's legacy would be?
Well, I think that he, you know, Roger lived long enough to kind of see what the legacy of the show was, which was that it had an enormous influence on people like me of my generation. So I think that's a big part of the legacy, is the people that it inspired. And then certainly there's movies that they championed, that they helped get out into the world and find an audience. Filmmakers they championed, that they helped establish careers. And then, you know, there's lots of other ways that they influenced the movie world. I mean, we could be here all day talking about it. There's a whole book I wrote about it. But there, I do think that the show, even though there is not a Siskel and Ebert type show on the air right now, at least about movies, I think it has this enormous legacy. And maybe there's lots of other shows we can think of on television now that are not about movies, but that have that same spirit and energy of people passionately arguing about something, you know, sports, politics, whatever it is, that model has become enormously successful in other worlds, just maybe not as popular, at least on television, for movie talk.
Matt Singer, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. I'm sure that Roger and Gene would give your book two thumbs up without any arguing.
Well, I would hope so. That's a very kind thing to say. I don't know that that's the case, because they did have a tendency to argue about a lot of things, but that's a lovely compliment, so thank you.
And until next time, the balcony is closed. Matt Singer is the author of Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Find out more about Matt, Gene, and Roger at WPR.org/beta.
The reason it is such a 90s concept is that it basically did not survive the 90s, this idea of selling out. You know, it's just not a thing people agonize about at all anymore.
Coming up, rock critic and podcast host Rob Harvilla joins us to talk about 60 songs that explain the 90s. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In the time of chimpanzees.